Hello and welcome to Salvation and Stuff. Thank you for listening. Welcome. In the last episode, we discussed the critical importance the foundation is to a building. We established that Jesus is the foundation of the Christian faith and is to be the foundation of each of our own individual theological houses. Because all of the Christian faith hinges upon the person and work of Jesus, we'll begin to consider him, who he was in time and history, who he claimed to be, and why this matters to each person today. Welcome to Foundational Faith, the What and Whys, Episode 2 starts now. So a few years ago, Jim Carrey, the actor, came out with a documentary called I Needed Color. He said he was in New York and he was looking around and it was a sad winter morning and it was dark and he just thought, man, I really need some color. So he started painting with really bright and bold colors, and paintings were all over the house, and he was, you know, eating dinner on paintings, and he couldn't have room to walk in his house. He was painting so much. Some of the paintings are really cool. Some of them are a little abstract, a little too much for my taste, but some of them are really good. One of them is a picture of Jesus's face. And it's maybe, I don't know, 5 feet by 4 feet, you know, pretty big. And it's a picture of Jesus's face. Again, really bold and bright colors. And this is what Jim Carrey says about the painting. Here, I'll just play it in his own words.
The energy that surrounds Jesus is electric. I don't know if Jesus is real. I don't know if he lived. I don't know what he means. But the paintings of Jesus are really my desire to convey Christ consciousness. I wanted you to have the feeling when you looked in his eyes that he was accepting of who you are. I wanted him to be able to stare at you and heal you from the painting. You can find every race in the face of Jesus. And I think that's how every race imagines Jesus. They imagine him as their own.
So I don't know Jim Carrey. You know, I'm not trying to judge Jim Carrey. But when he says, I don't know if Jesus is real, I don't know if he lived, I don't know what he means. More specifically, the part where he says, I don't know if he lived. So if I'm to judge Jim Carrey based on this sentence alone, because I don't know the guy, I'm not up to speed on his life, then to be honest, I really am concerned. Why? Well, because... And I don't know, I don't want to, again, don't want to have this be a time of ripping on Jim Carrey, but that's just a stupid thing to say. It'd be equivalent of me saying, you know, I don't know if Julius Caesar, you know, actually lived, or I don't know if John Adams or, you know, anybody, you know, any other well-established figure in history, I don't know if they lived, I don't know what they are, I just don't know. That kind of be a stupid thing to say, because when I say that, I don't know if Julius Caesar actually lived, then I would be kind of denying all the evidence throughout history that points to the fact that Julius Caesar actually lived. And so when someone says, I don't know if Jesus actually lived, it's not just a kind of a agnostic thing to say, but it's kind of a more of a self-imposed ignorant thing to say. So I'm hoping he corrected it. I don't, maybe he didn't mean that, but that's what the quote says. I don't know if he lived. Now, Jim Carrey is from Canada, so maybe that might explain something, but even then, we don't want to hold that against him. So what's wrong with saying, you know, I don't know if Jesus actually lived? Well, because when we say that, and that's okay to honestly ask that question, because the evidence is out there, and we're going to look into it today, just establishing the fact that Jesus actually lived. But the problem with just kind of saying willy-nilly, yeah, I don't know if Jesus existed. I don't know if he lived. The problem with that is it kind of makes Jesus comparable to like a Bigfoot or a mermaid or Santa Claus. You know, some fictional person that we're like, yeah, I don't know. It's questionable. And there's an astronomer and astrophysicist, Linda Hardin, who answers this question. She answers the question, what if Santa Claus was real? Okay? So she answers this question based from her field of study, and it's quite enlightening. So, okay, I don't know if Santa Claus is real. Maybe he was, maybe not. Maybe not, but she answers the question. And this is written years ago, and I'm going to read just a little bit of what she says. So she says, the payload on the sleigh adds another interesting element. Assuming that each child gets nothing more than a medium-sized Lego set, which is 2 pounds, the sleigh is carrying 321,000 tons, not counting Santa, who is invariably described as overweight. On land, conventional reindeer can pull no more than 300 pounds. Even granting that, flying reindeer could pull 10 times the normal amount. We cannot do the job with 8 or with even 9. We would need 214,000 reindeer. This increases the payload, not even counting the weight of the sleigh, to 353,000 tons. Again, for comparison, this is 4 times the weight of the Queen Elizabeth. 353,000 tons traveling at 650 miles per second creates enormous air resistance. Okay, this is where it gets really good now. So we have Santa cruising with 214,000 reindeer going 650 miles per second. And this is what happens. She continues, this will heat up the reindeer in the same fashion as spacecrafts re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. The lead pair of reindeer will absorb 14.3 quintillion joules of energy per second each. In short, they will burst into flame almost instantaneously, exposing their reindeer behind them and create deafening sonic booms in their wake. The entire reindeer team will be vaporized within 4.26 thousandths of a second. Santa, meanwhile, will be subjected to centrifugal forces 17,000 times greater than gravity. A 250-pound Santa, which seems ludicrously slim, would be pinned to the back of a sleigh by 4,315,015 pounds of force. End quote. So, wow. Yeah. In short, the reindeer just got wrecked. And Santa did as well. So, Linda Hardin concludes. She says, if Santa ever did deliver presents on Christmas Eve, he's dead now. It seems reasonable to me, even if he existed, he would either burn at once or just be a fat liar who lives comfortably in a North Pole hideout surrounded by little eunuchs with pointy ears. Yeah, Linda Hardin just broke off every child's dreams that Santa Claus is real. And she did it in a violent way. But in an honest way, you know. And she says, you know, hey, she says, here's the conclusions. If Santa did live, he's dead now. He's a piece of ash floating around in space. Or he's a little fat liar who lives in the North Pole. And you can, you know, decide on that. But essentially what Linda did was give a reasonable and rational answer as to why Santa Claus does not exist. And as Christians, we need to give a reasonable and rational answer for why Jesus did exist. And that's real easy because no one really questions whether Jesus actually existed. We need to give a rational and thoughtful answer as to why Jesus existed. And so when we do that, that's called apologetics. And apologetics might sound like a fancy word, but it's really not. It just means to give an answer. So some examples in the New Testament The word apologetics is used about 17 times in the New Testament, and it simply means to give an answer. It doesn't mean to apologize for anything. It just means to give an answer. So Paul, in the book of Philippians, he wrote, this is when he was in prison, "Just as it is right for me to think this of you all, because I have you in my heart, inasmuch as both in my chains and in the defense," and that word defense is apologia, "and confirmation of the gospel, you are all partakers with me of grace." So Paul says, I'm defending the gospel, I'm apologia, I'm giving an answer for the defense of the gospel and the confirmation of the gospel. That's where one instance where the word apologetics or apologia is given. Another one is 1 Peter 5, 3:15, which says believers. Well, Peter's saying believers, we need to have an answer. We need to be ready to give an answer. We need to make a defense to everyone who asks us to give an account for the hope that is within us. So as believers, we have this tremendous hope that this life isn't all there is, that Jesus resurrected, and because he resurrected, he claimed to be God. He claimed to be able to forgive sins, and that if we believe in him, we too will resurrect from the dead and have everlasting life, eternal life. That's an amazing hope. It's a crazy hope, but it's a true hope that we need to be able to give rational answers for. Okay, how do you believe something? Explain it to me. And so Peter says in chapter 3, verse 15, believers, we always need to be ready to make a defense to everyone who asks us to give an account for the hope that is in within us. That the word defense is apologia, to give an answer. And so now we want to give, right now, we want to give an apologia. We want to give an answer as to how we know Jesus actually existed as a person. And so the biggest source that documents the life of Jesus is, of course, the Bible, the New Testament. And that's written by about 10 different authors from, anywhere from 40 AD to 100 AD. But we're not going to concentrate on the Bible now. We're going to do that later. Right now, we'll just concentrate on ancient non-Christian sources that affirm the life of Jesus. So the first one is Josephus, the Roman Jewish historian. He lived from about 37 to 100 AD, and he chronicled the times that he lived in. And he says, about this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he wrought surprising feats. He was the Christ. When Pilate condemned him to be crucified, those who had come to love him did not give up their affection for him. On the third day he appeared, restored to life, and the tribe of Christians has not disappeared. So that was written by Josephus. Again, he lived in from about 37 to 100 AD. He was not a Christian, but just a historian who lived in the same time and place, or just after Jesus died and resurrected. So he was right there. So next we have the Roman historian Tacitus. So in 64 AD, Rome was burned down, and Tacitus recorded how Nero blamed the Christians. He writes, "Nero fastened the guilt on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Christus," which is what he's saying is Christ, speaking of Jesus, "Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of Pontius Pilate. and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. So this is the Roman historian Tacitus saying there's a group of people called Christians. They follow this man named Christus, which is Christ, and says that he suffered the extreme penalty, that would be crucifixion, during the reign of Tiberius. So he under Pontius Pilate. So he has all these details about who Jesus was. And again, he's obviously not speaking from a Christian point of view, but the Christians were hated at that time, and that's clearly evident from his record. We have another Roman governor of Bithynia in Asia Minor at about 112 AD. This is Pliny, and he was a Roman governor. And he really didn't know how to deal with Christians. So this is a letter that he wrote kind of asking, like, hey, what's going on? Because at the time, Christians were supposed to acknowledge that Caesar was almost divine, that he was a god, and Christians weren't doing that. So there was questions on how to actually deal with them. But he writes, quote, Christians were in the habit of meeting on a certain day before it was light, when they sang in alternate verses a hymn to Christ as to God, and bound themselves by a solemn oath not to do any wicked deeds, but never to commit any fraud, theft, or adultery, never to falsify their word or deny a trust when they should be called upon to deliver it. After which it was their custom to separate and then reassemble to partake of food, but food of an ordinary and innocent kind. So he's saying these Christians come together on a certain day of the week, and they sing songs to Christ as to a god, and then they bound themselves with solemn oaths that they wouldn't do wicked deeds, that they wouldn't commit adultery or fraud, and then they come back together at night and they have they partake of food and have dinner together. What am I supposed to do with these people? Are they breaking the law, or are they not? So that was the Roman governor of Bithynia. His name was Pliny. And forgive me if I'm mispronouncing these names. I probably am. So just a couple more. The Babylonian Talmud is a collection of Jewish rabbinical writings that has a large time period of collection between about 70 to 500 AD. And one of the books, it says, on the eve of the Passover, Yeshua, which is another word, which is the Jewish name for Jesus, Yeshua was hanged. For 40 days before the execution took place, a herald cried, "He is going forth to be stoned because he has practiced sorcery and enticed Israel to apostasy." Again, why was Jesus crucified in the first place? Because at the time, the Jewish leaders believed that he was a heretic, that he was an apostate, that he claimed to be God. And the Jews didn't believe that, and so they hung him on a cross, or had the Romans do it. And we'll just give one more source. This is Lucian of Samosata. He was a Roman Jewish historian who lived from about 125 to 180 AD. And he writes, "The Christians worship a man to this day, the distinguished person who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. It was impressed on them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment that they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws." Again, Lucian, a Samosata, writes that, again, a group of people named Christians worship a man to this day. He was crucified, and it was impressed on them that once they were converted, that they were considered brothers and sisters of each other, and that they deny the gods of Greece, and that they worship this crucified sage. So in just the last 5 or 10 minutes with 5 examples, extra biblical examples from historical documents, we confirm the New Testament's reliability of the historical person of Jesus. Again, I didn't want to spend too much. I kind of blew through this real fast because I didn't want to spend too much time on it, because questioning whether Jesus existed isn't really something that anybody disputes, because it's such common knowledge and so thoroughly documented throughout history in numerous languages and cultures that we just ran through it real fast. But let's summarize just on the 5 sources we cited right now. Let's just summarize. And I'm going to take this from Dr. Michael Gellhorn. He is a present-day Christian apologist, but he concludes this. He says, let's summarize what we've learned about Jesus from this examination of ancient non-Christian sources. Number one, both Josephus and Lucian indicate that Jesus was regarded as wise. Second, Pliny, the Talmud, and Lucian imply that he was a powerful and reverent teacher. Third, both Josephus and the Talmud indicate he performed miraculous feats. Fourth, Tacitus, Josephus, the Talmud, and Lucian all mention that he was crucified. Tacitus and Josephus say this occurred under Pontius Pilate, and the Talmud declares it happened on the eve of Passover. Fifth, there are possible references to the Christian belief in Jesus' resurrection in both Tacitus and Josephus. Sixth, Josephus records that Jesus' followers believed he was the Christ or Messiah. And finally, both Pliny and Lucian indicate that Christians worship Jesus as God. So it's pretty amazing. In such a short time, we quickly and easily established that Jesus was a real man who actually lived. And again, this isn't challenged by any rational person. So we kind of just dealt with it quickly, because there's more important questions to cover. So the more important question is, okay, who did Jesus think he was, and what does he want us to think about him? Sometimes Jesus spoke straightforwardly, which is kind of what I really like. Hey, just tell me, you know, squarely what's going on. Sometimes Jesus spoke cryptically, sometimes metaphorically, but he always spoke truthfully. And we need to remember that, because some things that Jesus says are hard to understand, and some of them are not. But look at this example from the book of John, chapter 10. Jesus said to them again, most assuredly I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All whoever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal and to kill and to destroy. I have come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling, he who is not the shepherd or who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. The wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. So right there we have Jesus saying two things. One, I am the door and all the sheep have to come through me. And then he says, I am the good shepherd and I give my life to protect the sheep. And other people don't do that. Other leaders don't do that. But I actually am the good shepherd and I lay my life down for the sheep. And he ends it by saying, no one takes it from me, my life from me, but I lay it down for myself. I have power to lay it down and I have power to take it up again. This command I have received from my Father. And then it says this, therefore there was division among the Jews because of these sayings. And many of them said, he has a demon and is mad. Why do you listen to him? So Jesus, again, has these bold claims. I'm the door of the sheep. If you come through me, you will be saved and you will find pasture and rest and protection. And I am the good shepherd. I lay my life down for the sheep. And the Jews hear him, and there's division among them. Some believe him and some don't. And those that don't say, no, he's crazy. He's like mad. Why do you guys even listen to him? There's more verses in from the book of John. These are considered the I am verses. This is where Jesus bluntly says who he is. In John chapter 4, he's talking to a woman at the well, and they're talking about the coming Messiah. And she says, I know that Messiah, who is called Christ, is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. And Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. Okay, so very clearly and straightforwardly, Jesus says, I am the Messiah. It's a great story from chapter 4 of John. In chapter 6, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never hunger, and he who believes in me will never thirst. John chapter 8, Jesus says, you are from below, but I am from above. You are of this world, and I am not of this world. Again, in chapter 8, we have one of the most bold declarations of who Jesus was. And he says, Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. And for reference, in Exodus chapter 3, Moses wants to know the name of God. And God answered and said, tell them I am sent you. I am. So the title I am was a direct reference to the name of God from Exodus chapter 3. And in John chapter 8, Jesus says, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am. He makes a clear reference that he himself was and is the I am. And people lost their mind after he said that because it was considered blasphemous. In John chapter 9, he says, while I am in the world, I am the light of the world. John 11, Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even if he dies. John 13:13, you call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. John 15, 1, Jesus said, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. So in answering the question, who did Jesus think he was? The scriptures are quite clear, especially from the book of John, where Jesus clearly and boldly states who he was, that he was someone who could forgive sins, that he had power and authority over people's bodies, over demonic spirits, over nature by causing the wind and the waves to cease. He claimed to be, before Abraham existed, that he was the I am. He claimed not only to be the Son of God, but God himself. And that's exactly why he was crucified. Because that sentiment, those sayings, those thoughts that he, claims that he had, were unbearable to the religious elite, to the Jewish community, because he was making himself out to be God. So the New Testament is very clear on who Jesus thought he was. But the question that is even more important than that is, who do we think Jesus was? Do we believe him to be true, or do we disbelieve him? In Mark chapter 8, there's a story where Jesus is walking with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And he was questioning his disciples as they're walking. He's saying, who do people say that I am? And so his disciples tell him, well, some people think you're kind of like John the Baptist resurrected. Others say Elijah, a prophet. And some other people say like you're just kind of one of many prophets. And he, Jesus, continued by questioning them. And he said, but who do you say that I am? That's the question that Jesus is asking you today. That's the question that Jesus is asking me today. Whether you have never really thought of that question or whether you have thought of that question for years, he's always asking us, who do you say that I am? How we answer this question is of extreme importance, right? It has to be. Because Jesus claimed that he is the resurrection and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except through him. So how we answer this question determines everything. C.S. Lewis, in his famous book, Mere Christianity, said it this way. He says, I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him, that him is Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us, and he did not intend to. C.S. Lewis is clearly stating there's a right answer and there's a wrong answer. You can call him a lunatic, you can call him a liar, or you can call him a Lord. But C.S. Lewis said, but don't call him a great moral teacher, because he didn't intend for us to just to come to that conclusion that he was a good man or he was a prophet or just a prophet. But he was either one of those three things, and I agree with C.S. Lewis on this. He was either a lunatic, he was a liar, or the Lord that he claimed to be. So how do we come to any conclusion regarding Jesus? We have to not only consider what he said and claimed, but more importantly, how he lived and what he did. Jesus himself testified about his crucifixion and resurrection. In this episode, we covered the words of Jesus. In our next episode, we'll look at the acts of Jesus, namely the resurrection. Because without the resurrection, there is no Christianity. There's no Christian faith. And there is no hope. But if the resurrection of Jesus is true, it changes everything. This will be our focus in the next episode. Thanks for listening.